Today is the first day of class, Monday, May 15th. We're going to be working on the endocrine system today. Okay, so we're going to talk about the endocrine system all this week and part of next week. This is a fairly long system, and a lot of people are kind of hit blindsided by the system. I recommend starting today or tomorrow with flashcards to help you keep stuff straight. And as we work through the material, I'll recommend some ways that may work well for you to do flashcards. I've also had students in the past, I know the spring semester, I had somebody load all the test questions off of the old test into the Quizlet website. Have you guys used Quizlet.com? Mm-hmm. Okay, so she said, and I think she told me she loaded something like a couple hundred questions onto Quizlet. So you may want to search for Bio211. You may want to include my last name. And Brianna said she posted a bunch of questions up there, so that may be a great way to study as well. Okay. It's okay. It's our introduction to endocrine. So I know most of you have come to this class from Bio210 at this school. And Bio210, the last topic you covered was the nervous system. So let me get your brain back into thinking about how the nervous system works. You may recall the nervous system works with a variety of neurotransmitters. So what are neurotransmitters? Chemical messengers. Good. And those chemical messengers are released by axon terminals. They travel across a gap known as? Synaptic cleft. Good. And they bind to receptors on the neighboring cell. So neurotransmitters and hormones work very similarly. They do have target cells in mind, and they both require some type of receptor to bind to. The difference is that neurotransmitters simply travel across a synaptic cleft, whereas hormones are slower because they use the bloodstream for transport. So I use this analogy of traveling on a train, which is fast response time for neurotransmitters, as opposed to the slow response time for the endocrine system. Let me give you an example of just how slow the endocrine system actually is. When babies are born, babies are something like 20 or 22 inches long. It takes you 13, 15, even 18 or 20 years to grow to your final destined height. So you may end up being 6 feet tall when you finally stop growing. So you think about maybe 15 or 20 years of growth time to get your body from 20 inches long to something like 70 inches long. So obviously hormones are not going to be fast acting. Some of them can be, but a lot of them are not intended to be fast acting messengers. They're meant to be slow acting over weeks, months, or even years. Okay, so on your sheet, if you do have a worksheet, the faster of our two controlling systems is the nervous system. That's because we don't have to mess with travel through the bloodstream. The slower system, of course, is your endocrine system. So what are you looking at here? Hormones or neurotransmitters? How do you know it's neurotransmitters? Good. You got yourself a synaptic cleft. Good. So hormones can work in a very similar fashion. They can be released from vesicles stored in axon terminals, but if they happen to hit the bloodstream, bingo, now you have something called a hormone. So hormones typically travel in the bloodstream. Neurotransmitters travel from one neuron to the neighboring cell across a cleft. So this may be the way a neurotransmitter talks to another nerve. It may also be the way a neurotransmitter talks to a muscle cell. Okay, so since we're in the endocrine system, let's have a discussion about the difference between endocrine and exocrine. What does endo as a prefix tell you? Good. Inside or within. And how about exo?
Outside.
Outside. Good. So the difference is, in order to get secretions or excretions moved to the outside world, then we have to travel through a duct system like you see here. Not a quack quack duct. This is a D-U-C-T duct. And of course, sweat and oil, mammary gland secretions, and tears all travel this way to the surface of your skin. So technically, those secretions are called excretions because they're being moved to the exterior of your body. Do you happen to see any ductwork in the endocrine gland? Okay, so how do those hormones travel then? Bloodstream, good. You know how diffusion works, right? Okay, so high concentration to low. That's how we're going to get those hormones into blood flow. They're going to be diffused into the bloodstream. So no ductwork is necessary for us to secrete those hormones. Let's see, on the bottom of your page, let's talk about the major endocrine glands. This picture has some very small words, so let me help you out. On your worksheet there, letter A, what do you think that points to? Good. P-I-N-E-A-L, pineal or pineal gland. That is letter A. Letters B and C go together. Good. Pituitary gland. So which one is anterior? So what does that mean letter B is? Posterior. Good. All right, so B is posterior pituitary. Letter C is anterior pituitary. Check out the difference between letters D and E. D is in the neck. It's called what?
Thyroid.
Thyroid, good. Letter E is over the heart and the chest. Thymus. Good. That's thymus for letter E. All right. Looks like letter F points to what glands?
Adrenal.
Good. Letter F is adrenal glands. What about G?
Pancreas,
good. Gonads include letters H and I. Specifically, letter H are ovaries. And what about I?
Testes.
Testes, good. So in fact, that is just the major endocrine glands. Your heart is an endocrine gland, so are your stomach and small intestines. So as we travel through this course, we'll talk about even other endocrine glands that are not part of this list here. If you do have a course pack today, do you have any questions on page 3? All right, let's flip on over to page 4 and talk about the definition of a hormone. We've pretty much been through this already, but we know it is a chemical messenger, and it differs from a neurotransmitter in how it travels. Bloodstream, good, good. So hormones are chemical messengers. They travel the bloodstream. I'm just checking to see if anybody still needs a slide. Okay. So I want to talk to you about how hormones arouse their target cells. In order for a hormone to talk to its target cell must have a receptor for that hormone. So when you look at something like the plasma membrane, you'll notice on the surface there's all sorts of structures. Back in Bio-210, we call this external surface the glycocalyx. It was a sticky surface. It had a bunch of different things sticking off. Some of those items were used for recognition. And then for this case, some of these items are used to receive and bind to one of those hormones. So when we talk about hormones talking to their receptor cells or their target areas, we have to appreciate that there are receptors not only on the outside surface of those targets, but some of those targets even have receptors inside the cell, and more specifically, inside the nucleus. So let's talk about the two chemical categories of hormones. Some hormones are categorized as amino acid-based or protein hormones. There is another class of lipids, which are specifically made from cholesterol, and those are our steroid-based hormones. Anybody else need a sign in? Okay, so I'm going to need one of those easy buttons that says, remember back in Bio210? Here we go. Remember back in Bio210, you talked about the plasma membrane. Some things could work their way through the plasma membrane if they were small and if they were made of what?
Lipids.
Good. So if you're small, if you're made of a lipid, you can travel through the plasma membrane. Ah, there's our list. So that means the steroid or lipid-based hormones can travel through the phospholipid bilayer. Those protein hormones cannot. In fact, those protein hormones are too big. They're not going to squeeze through that phospholipid bilayer. Therefore, there are two mechanisms that these particular hormones use. Let's tackle the first one, called a secondary messenger system, that is utilized by protein-based hormones. The other mechanism utilized by lipids is called the direct gene activation mechanism. So which one of these chemicals can go straight through the phospholipids? Lipids. Yeah, the steroids or the lipids can go right on through that phospholipid bilayer. Just checking to see if anybody needs this slide. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about the secondary messenger system. This is how hormones talk to their target cells. And keep in mind, these target cells must have a receptor for that hormone. If there is no receptor, that hormone just drifts on by and doesn't even talk to that cell at all. In fact, there would be no way to communicate with that cell without a receptor. So you'll notice that in this instance, a hormone like epinephrine comes from the outside and docks with the receptor. Do you notice anything about the way they fit together? Mm-hmm. Look like a pretty good fit. Mm-hmm. They kind of look like they were made for each other, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that hormone has a pretty nice fit with its receptor. That means that other hormones with different shapes can't bind with that receptor. So it's kind of like a lock and a key thing. Only that particular hormone can bind with that particular receptor. Once they bind, that hormone as a first messenger has done its job. That binding process is going to activate chemical reactions inside the cell. We're going to turn on something called a G protein. We're going to turn on a second messenger called CAMP. CAMP stands for cyclic AMP. And I know you know it's Buddy. Who is the Buddy to CAMP?
ATP
and ADP, exactly. ATP is 3 phosphates, ADP is 2, AMP is 1 phosphate, that's adenosine monophosphate. So, yeah, you know CAMP's Buddy. This is a low-level energy form that is activated by the binding of that hormone out there on the outside with its receptor. So that camp second messenger travels and turns on enzymes like protein kinase. Kinase, A-S-E, says to you what? It's an enzyme, exactly. What do enzymes do for chemical reactions?
Speed it up.
Speed it up, right. So if this cell is in the process of undergoing mitosis, protein kinase says, faster. Yeah, do it faster. So that's what we're going to look at. We're going to look at the binding of epinephrine that turns on CAMP, and that makes whatever this cell is doing happen faster. Okay, so whatever it is, whether it's mitosis, metabolism, that kinase enzyme says do it faster. Let me give you an example of how this works. All of our hormones that we discuss are protein-based, with the exception of your adrenal cortex hormones, which are steroids, and your sex hormones, like testosterone and estrogen. So the majority of your hormones work by the secondary messenger system. In order for this process to work, where must you have a receptor? Outside the cell or inside the cell?
Outside.
Why can't you have a receptor inside?
It
can't get in, right? Because proteins are too big to make their way inside the cell. I have a mental image of having a pet elephant that wants to play, and you can't open the door and say, come on in, pet elephant, you know, come in my front door and we'll play in the living room. Not happening. So when your pet elephant wants to play, he rings the doorbell, right? And when he rings the doorbell, you say, oh, pet elephant wants to play. Okay, I know what to do now. I'll get him some peanuts, and you start turning on these chemical activities inside the cell. Why can't the pet elephant come in your house and play?
Too big.
Exactly. So these proteins are too big. They have to dock on the outside with the receptor. Therefore, the receptor has to be on the outside. So when your pet elephant wants to play, he rings your doorbell. And by being a protein receptor and binding with one of these protein hormones, it's like ringing the doorbell. And as long as the doorbell gets rung, what happens inside? Protein kinase says to the chemical reactions, you should speed up. Yeah, whatever your cell's doing, protein kinase says do it faster. Okay? So, of course, you can't let in the hormone, it's too big like your pet elephant, but we can still send our message by way of a second messenger. What was the name of that second messenger? CAMP. Yeah, cyclic AMP is CAMP. That is our second messenger. What if you don't have a receptor for the hormone? What happens in this cell? Nothing. It goes on by, right. It says, nothing here for me to look at. This keeps on drifting. There's got to be a receptor on that cell in order for there to be any communication happening there. So it's like going to play with somebody and they have no doorbell and nothing to knock with. So, you know, you can't get anybody to the door that way if there's no receptor to receive the hormone. How about questions on this? Does this one make sense? Okay. Anything I can clarify for you? So let's talk about how lipids move. Lipids can move simply by diffusion across the cell membrane and into the interior of your target cells. The steroid hormones we're talking about are cholesterol-based. Things like sex hormones, testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, and the adrenal cortex hormones, which includes cortisol, aldosterone, and more sex hormones. That's it. That's the minority of our hormones. The majority actually operate by a secondary messenger system. So here's your steroid. It can travel through the phospholipid bilayer because, of course, the bilayer agrees with the chemical composition. And notice where it finally encounters its receptor, inside the nucleus. So that hormone binds its receptor. Together, they go over and turn on a region of DNA, and transcription begins. You'll notice that transcription produces a strand of mRNA. That mRNA travels to the ribosomes, and now you perform translation. What process does this sound like? Protein synthesis. Yeah. So what do you make as a result of protein synthesis? New proteins, right? Okay. So this process of having a steroid come into your cell and bind one of your DNA regions simply activates making proteins. Let's think big picture here. Why would someone take testosterone injections?
Hypogonadism.
That might be one. What else? What does it do to your muscles? Build them up, right? What's muscle made of? Proteins, yeah. So, of course, that's a great example of a steroid hormone. Testosterone enters the cell, binds DNA, turns on protein synthesis, and there we go. We make new proteins as a result, so we can make new muscle that way. So all of our protein-based hormones are going to use secondary messenger, but our steroid hormones, oddly enough, turn on protein synthesis. Okay? So don't fall into that trap of saying that protein hormones make proteins. It is the steroid hormones, in fact, that make proteins. See how that works? Okay. On your worksheet, there may be a blank. Where is the receptor for your steroid hormone?
Inside.
Yeah, it's an intracellular receptor. Okay, so that blank is intracellular receptor. This seems like a good point for us to have a quick break. Would you like about a 5 or 10 minute break to get up and move around? Mm-hmm. I've got about 5 of 2. Why don't you come back about 2:05 and we'll pick back up with hormone interactions. That'll be on page 5. Okay, let me get you back into the course pack. We're going to be on the top of page 5. Okay, so kind of changing gears here a little bit. Let's talk about these three terms and how they relate to how hormones are going to be interacting with each other. Not necessarily their target organs, but with other hormones. So some hormones are classified as being permissive to other hormones. That means that one hormone must be present in order for another hormone to do its job. Sometimes women who want to get pregnant will go to their doctor's office and complain that they've been trying for X amount of time, that they've been unsuccessful in getting pregnant, and they may be prescribed thyroid hormone. Well, what does thyroid hormone do? Metabolism, yeah. And so you say, okay, well, hormones like thyroid must be permissive to other hormones like estrogen or FSH and LH to be able to do their jobs correctly. So even though thyroid doesn't directly relate to reproduction, it gives permission for other hormones to be able to work. So thyroid hormone is a great example of one that gives permission for other hormones to be able to function. And you've heard about synergists and antagonists from Bio 210. Which of these works together? Good. So insulin and epinephrine, glucagon and epinephrine, cortisol all raise blood sugar. They're considered synergists for that reason. While insulin and glucagon work against each other, and they would be classified as what?
Antagonist.
Good.
Is it important that we have to know which ones work together, which actual hormone will work together, and which one wouldn't, or just the concept of synergism and antagonism?
For now, the concept, but as we get through this chapter, you'll be able to pair them up as synergists or as antagonists. I think by the time you finish, you'll be able to do that.
Okay.
And there may be a question on the test or two that says, pick the synergist or pick the antagonist. How about other questions on these three terms? Okay. Let's talk about the stimulation process, because we just got through talking about secondary messenger and direct gene activation. So when we talk about getting hormones released into the bloodstream, there are three different ways that we can stimulate the hormones from their glands. The first kind of stimulation is called humoral stimulation, not to be confused with the last one here, which is hormonal stimulation. Okay? Back in the 1600s and 1700s, people called the bodily fluids the humors. Wasn't anything funny about it, but nonetheless, they had blood and bile as part of the humors of the body. Well, the word is stuck, and the term humoral stimulation involves blood concentration. So if you're looking at blood concentration of an ion like sodium or a nutrient like glucose, that can prod a gland into hormone production, okay? So let me give you an example of humoral stimulation. So you go to Krispy Kreme, they've got the hot now sign flashing, get yourself a dozen donuts and you dive in. What happens to your blood sugar?
Goes up.
Goes up, okay. Now you've got one of these. You've got a nutrient called glucose that is increased in your blood. What hormone helps to lower your blood sugar?
Insulin.
Insulin, good. So what gland makes insulin?
Pancreas.
Bingo, good. So all that blood sugar in your bloodstream is going to humorally stimulate your pancreas to release insulin. And as long as your blood sugar is too high, we're going to stimulate the release of insulin. Okay? Let me give you another example. Let's say that you've been drinking a lot of milk and having a lot of dairy products lately. What does that put into your bloodstream?
Calcium.
Calcium, good. Now, which hormone lowers blood calcium? Its antagonist is?
Calcitonin.
Good. So, calcitonin is made by your thyroid gland, and it produces or activates osteoblasts to help deposit more calcium to your bones. That means the thyroid is humorally stimulated by high levels of calcium. Okay? So the catch is, if you've got high blood concentration of some ion like sodium or potassium or some nutrient, you know, things like glucose, for instance, that's going to trigger that gland to release a hormone. Let's talk about neural stimulation. This time, what stimulates a hormone to be released?
Nerves,
good. Okay, so we know that axon terminals can store vesicles full of chemicals, and if that is released across a synaptic cleft to neighboring cell, we call it neurotransmitter, right? But if in fact what is over here is a blood vessel, well, now we say that was a neural stimulation. So the nerve was stimulated, it released a vesicle full of neurotransmitter, and the neurotransmitter now hops in the bloodstream. We should change the name, because once it's in the bloodstream, that chemical is now called a hormone. Yeah. So there's a couple that work this way. Oxytocin is one, antidiuretic is another, and one you're probably very familiar with, epinephrine. So they can operate neurally. They can also operate other ways. We'll talk about those in specific detail. But hey, once they hop in the bloodstream from a nerve, then of course they're going to be neurally stimulated. Do these two make sense so far? Okay. The last one there is called hormonal stimulation, and catch the word is a little different. Hormones are going to do the stimulating this time. So when a hormone is made by, say, the pituitary gland, and that hormone targets the thyroid gland to produce a hormone, this is hormonal stimulation. One hormone targets another gland to release its hormones. throw some examples out for you. Let's say that we've got an excess amount of potassium in the bloodstream. That excess amount of the potassium ions is going to stimulate the release of aldosterone from the adrenal glands. What does this sound like? Humoral, right? What was the clue that gave it away? Ions, yeah. There's ions in the bloodstream, and that, of course, stimulates a hormone to help fix the levels of ions. Let's talk about another one. Let's say that if you're, you know, excited, you know, you've got a test coming up, how exciting that is, right? Okay. So excitement produces sympathetic response, and sympathetic response induces epinephrine and norepinephrine release into the bloodstream. All right, so since it's a nervous system that does the stimulating here, what does this sound like?
Neural.
Sounds like neural. Good. Let's do another one. When you are stressed for that upcoming test, then you may release more glucose into the bloodstream based on a hormone called cortisol. Okay, so cortisol helps to regulate blood concentration of glucose. This one is?
Normal.
Humoral. Yeah. Once again, humoral. What was the clue?
Blood.
Blood. Good. Let's see. Let's do another one. When moms are breastfeeding babies, moms produce a hormone in their brain called prolactin-releasing hormone. It's called PRH for short. That hormone travels to the anterior pituitary and releases another hormone called prolactin. And so prolactin is turned on by another hormone. This kind of control is?
Hormonal.
You got it. That is hormonal. Good. What was the clue there? Good. One hormone stimulates another. Good. Okay. Do you need any more examples here? Do you feel okay? Okay. All right. So that should do it for page 5. If you like flashcards, page 6 is for you. And if you happen to have the most recent copy of the course pack, I reorganized some of these pages. In fact, page 7 is something that you could literally print and cut into instant flashcards. So that may be a great way to study for page 7. If you don't have the most current copy of the course pack, you may just want to pull this up on the computer when you get home and take a look. I've taken what used to be in the slideshow and then just placed it here in the course pack. So back when you studied hypothalamus and Bio-210, we often talk about it as a home for homeostasis. This is a place where we house hunger and thirst, body temperature regulation, and the endocrine system is housed here. We oftentimes talk in biology class about the pituitary gland being the master endocrine gland, but I think that gives you the wrong idea because it's in fact the hypothalamus that really runs the show here. So it is a piece of nervous tissue in our brains, but it also produces hormones that regulate the pituitary gland. So you can see there's a relationship, a really close one here, between the hypothalamus up here. There's a stalk called the infundibulum, and that connects us to an anterior and a posterior portion of the pituitary. The pituitary, by the way, sits in a little cradle. It's called the cella turcica. Do you remember which bone houses the cella turcica?
Sphenoid.
Yep, that's it. Sphenoid has the cella turcica. So it, in fact, sits right snugly in that little cradle of bone, and it doesn't have a whole lot of room to expand in case it would hypertrophy or grow bigger. Okay, so the case is the hypothalamus has a blood connection or a portal system with the anterior pituitary. So hormones made in the hypothalamus will target the anterior pituitary to make them release its hormones. I think you can see here in the posterior pituitary, it's a different setup. These are neurons that travel with very long axons into the posterior pituitary, And these little bud-like endings are what? Axon terminals, yeah. And see how they're sitting on a blood supply? Just like here? Okay, so when we release those hormones into the bloodstream, we say they've been neurally stimulated. So this, in fact, is how it works for the posterior pituitary. So let's take the anterior pituitary first. The anterior pituitary is actually made up of endocrine or glandular tissue. That means it's made up of epithelial tissue. The posterior pituitary, by contrast, is made up of nervous tissue. So it doesn't actually make its hormones. It only releases hormones that are stored there by the hypothalamus. Okay? So we're going to communicate with the anterior pituitary using releasing hormones and inhibiting hormones. Let's talk through those first. Does this look like a list you want to memorize? Me neither. Okay, let me give you the shortcut, an easy way to learn this. All of these hormones have something in common, right? What is it?
Made by the hypothalamus.
Made by the hypothalamus, good. What other clues do you see?
RH.
Bingo, RH and IH. Okay, so this is the easy way. Releasing hormones are abbreviated RH. Inhibiting hormones, IH. They are always made by your hypothalamus, and their target will be the anterior pituitary. Hey, problem solved. Now you don't have to memorize the list. Okay, RH and IH hormones are made by the hypothalamus. They target the anterior pituitary. So if you leave here knowing nothing else today, take this comment with you. Releasing hormones and inhibiting hormones are made by your hypothalamus. They will target your anterior pituitary, turning on the production of hormones. This is a great time for us to practice. Does this sound like hormonal, humoral, or neural stimulation?
Hormonal.
Yeah, it's one hormone telling another gland to make its hormones. I do want to tell you this, on the test, my job is not to test you on how well you can memorize abbreviations. So what I will do for you is, for you've got growth hormone, releasing hormone, I'll have in parentheses GHRH. So if you know it one way or the other, you're bound to recognize something on the test. You know, so all of these will be written out fully and also have the abbreviations on the test. So releasing hormones are the gas pedal, and the inhibiting hormones are the brake pedal. So that means that growth hormone releasing hormone is made by your hypothalamus. It tells the anterior pituitary to make more what? Growth hormone, right. If you have too much growth hormone, a negative feedback loop ensues, and GHIH will do what to growth hormone production?
Stop it,
yeah. So you have basically a gas and a brake pedal here that can tweak and make sure you're producing the correct amount of hormones. We actually don't talk about TIH, thyroid inhibiting hormone, but we will talk about thyroid releasing hormone. Don't let the name throw you off, because there is in fact a thyroid gland. But this particular hormone, thyroid releasing hormone, targets what?
Thyroid.
Pituitary, yeah. So don't let thyroid throw you off. That's the ultimate place we're going, but TRH comes from the hypothalamus. It targets the anterior pituitary. Sure. If you've got too little growth hormone, hypothalamus releases more GHRH. And then now if you've got too much growth hormone, you shut it down by having GHIH come from the hypothalamus. So it's a way to tweak you back into the normal levels. Corticotropic releasing hormone is a mouthful. I'll go ahead and tell you there's a great clue built in here. The ultimate message eventually ends up with your adrenal cortex. That's the outer portion of your adrenal gland. That's not where this particular hormone goes, though. All releasing hormones target what? Yeah, anterior pituitary. So eventually the message gets to the adrenal glands. Likewise, gonadotropic releasing hormone ultimately gets a message to the gonads, but that's not where this releasing hormone goes. Where does this hormone target? Anterior pituitary. And then finally, these two hormones, prolactin releasing and prolactin inhibiting, will also target the anterior pituitary. One turns on milk production, that's the releasing hormone. What turns it off? So in most of us, which one's in control? The inhibiting, yeah. Unless you're breastfeeding, the inhibiting hormone is in control. So it's kind of an odd case there. Most of the time, the releasing hormone's the one that's in favor of production. But in some cases, you know, we don't want that hormone turned on. Okay, so I hope that this helps you from memorizing that list. Just remember that RH and IH says, I am made by the hypothalamus. And what is my target organ? Good, anterior pituitary. All right. Since we're talking about the hypothalamus, let me mention ADH and oxytocin. Oxy, or oxytocin, is made by your hypothalamus, and it travels down some really long axons, and it's stored here in your posterior pituitary. So I'm going to put over here that oxytocin, O-X-Y, and ADH are stored in your posterior pituitary. Okay, so let me clarify. Where are those two hormones actually made?
Hypothalamus.
Hypothalamus, good. Catch this question. Where are ADH and oxytocin released from? Good. Does the posterior pituitary make any hormones?
No.
No, it only stores ADH and oxytocin and releases those two. ADH and oxytocin are actually made up here in the hypothalamus. Okay, bet on that question being on the test. What does the posterior pituitary make? The answer is nothing. I know that feels wrong to pick the answer that says nothing, but that is the right answer. We'll talk a little more about those two on the next couple of pages. What I thought I would do is continue working you through releasing, inhibiting, and the relationship with the anterior pituitary. Sure. How about questions so far? So let me throw out a hormone you may not have heard of before. It's called melanocyte releasing hormone. Where is it made? Melanocyte releasing hormone.
Hypothalamus,
right? And its target is? You got it, anterior pituitary. Good. So whatever releasing hormone and whatever inhibiting hormone comes from the hypothalamus, they all target the anterior pituitary. Okay? And we're going to say that over and over to ourselves until it's just a second habit, right? It's just like routine. Anybody still need this slide? Okay. So just a reminder that the anterior pituitary is endocrine gland tissue. The posterior pituitary is nervous tissue. So when people talk about having pituitary gland issues, which portion do you think has more of a capability of enlarging?
Anterior.
Yeah, anterior. So it's endocrine tissue, which means it's actually epithelial in nature. And what do you know about the nature of epithelial tissue and its repair rate?
Fast,
yeah. So when people have a pituitary that's grown and enlarged, it is the anterior that's likely the culprit there. The posterior, since it's nervous tissue, we know that nervous tissue doesn't like to grow very fast or repair at all. So unlikely to have a hypertrophy or an excess growth occur back there in the posterior pituitary. You know, I did mention that this is sitting in the sella turcica, that saddle, that little seat that's found in your sphenoid bone. And if someone has a hypertrophy situation of that anterior pituitary, it can often push on the optic nerves. The optic nerves cross, they make a chiasma right about the location where these glands sit, and someone may have pressure being put on those optic nerves. So somebody may say, I've got pressure behind my eyes. If they check and it's not the sinuses, then they may say, let's look at that pituitary gland. So an ophthalmologist or an optometrist may not be able to directly see what's pushing on them, but after doing a brain scan, they can say, oh, okay, that's enlarged, and it would be, in fact, pushing against those optic nerves. So, in fact, it is the eye doctor who may be one of the first ones to diagnose pituitary gland enlargement. If somebody has enlargement of the pituitary gland, you can end up hypersecreting all of these hormones. What does it mean to hypersecrete?
Too much,
yeah. So you can end up with a whole bunch of problems if you have excess of this list here. All right, so this is something I would put on a flashcard. These are 6 protein-based hormones produced and released by the anterior pituitary. One thing that may help you, these are stimulating or tropic in nature. Sometimes the word will say stimulating or tropic, but not all of them do. So there's kind of a gray area. It's not 100% rule with this case. So since these are protein-based hormones, do they use a secondary messenger or a direct gene activation mechanism?
Secondary.
Good. So where's their receptor?
On the outside.
On the outside, good. Does this particular set of hormones activate CAMP or protein synthesis?
CAMP.
They activate CAMP, good. So these all behave as the first messenger of that secondary messenger system. They pass the buck into the interior of that cell. So just taking a look at this list, are there any that you think you can guess what they do? Which ones kind of tell you what they do? Good. So at least three, right? Growth hormone tells you, hey, grow. Okay, you came to class and paid for this class to learn that tidbit of knowledge, right? Okay. Thyroid stimulating hormone, of course. Stimulate the thyroid. That's good. And what about prolactin? Milk production. Good. So we've got, hey, three of the six knocked out of the list here. All right. Anybody still need this slide? Okay. So, yeah, growth hormone does exactly what its name implies. It tells your body cells to grow. Almost every body cell has a receptor for growth hormone. So that means growth hormone can target almost every cell in your body. The places where you really see it is in your muscles and bones, and oddly enough, your liver, which has the capacity to regenerate. So you ever have, like, say, 3 or 4 hours of sleep one night and you feel like just awful the next day? Okay, so you wonder why you're feeling so bad. Part of it has to do with the lack of repairs that were done while you were sleeping. You'll notice that growth hormone levels increase while we sleep. That's why it's really important for little kids who are growing to get an adequate night's sleep. If they don't sleep enough during the night, then they can stunt their growth. And as adults, you know, we're no longer growing taller, but we're still repairing our cells. We may end up having diseases come about because we're unable to repair and replace those new cells. So actually a really important hormone for us to have. They have sometimes thought it was like the fountain of youth. They thought that if they gave people growth hormone injections, it might make you feel youthful again. But there's a really scary side effect of having excess growth hormone as an adult. Do you know what it is? Yeah, acromegaly. Yeah, so that's a really scary thought about, you know, fountain of youth versus acromegaly. I don't know, there's a fine line there. All right, anybody still need this slide? Okay. And by the way, I'm going to flip you over to page 7 in just a moment so you can see the mechanism here. Anybody still need this one? Okay. So this is what I've cut and pasted into your course pack on page 7. On the top left, you have growth hormone releasing hormone. That is made by the hypothalamus. It targets the what? Anterior pituitary. Good. In response, the anterior pituitary produces growth hormone. And of course, growth hormone targets nearly every body cell, and those cells then in turn grow larger. So the mechanism starts with growth hormone releasing hormone activating growth hormone's release. Now, what if you want to shut down growth hormone production? Yeah, use the inhibiting hormone instead of the releasing hormone. Good. So I'd like to spend a moment talking with you about some disorders. In order to understand the disorders, I need to make sure we've got two words clear, hypersecretion and hyposecretion. Which one of those means an excess production?
Hyper.
Good. And hypo means?
Too little.
Yeah, not enough. Good. Just checking to see if you need this before I flip on to the next slide. Anybody still using it? So let's talk through these three problems. We've got gigantism, which is a hypersecretion issue. I didn't leave you a whole lot of room to jot this down in the new version of the course pack. Acromegaly is also a hypersecretion issue, but notice the timing. It's for adults, not children. Pituitary dwarfism is a hyposecretion issue in kids. So for these three disorders, do we point the finger at the pituitary or at the hypothalamus? Who's making growth hormone? Yeah, pituitary. So the pituitary, because this particular portion is endocrine or epithelial tissue in nature, it can grow bigger and hypersecrete these hormones. So it may in fact not be the fault of the hypothalamus. It may be the extra growth of the pituitary gland. All right, I'm just checking to see if you still need this slide. Y'all good? Okay. So gigantism can result in changes that make the DNA produce, you know, a person that may be 6.5 feet, 7 feet, 8 feet, or even taller. There have been people throughout recorded history who have been 11 feet and 14 feet in height. And you think about, wow, you know, every time you add all these inches on, you're talking about pounds of weight that those joints have to support. So, you know, we have this mental concept of people like Andre the Giant, who's like a physically strong giant, but in fact, the rib cage does not accommodate the big body, neither does the heart, and neither do the joints. So you actually have a person that is not really physically built to be a strong, capable giant. You know, think of somebody, he was like 450 pounds at this height, he was like 7'6", but he was actually not that strong because of the weight that puts on his joints. This man actually had both gigantism and acromegaly, so after his epiphyseal plates closed in his late teen years, he still had excess growth hormone. So what problem is acromegaly? Endochondral ossification or excess appositional ossification? Appositional, yeah. So what is appositional growth? Wider, yeah. So the bones grow thicker and wider. So you notice his facial features look exaggerated, very big brow ridge, nasal bone, jawbone, very big hands. This all comes from having acromegaly after those epiphyseal plates close. This woman had gigantism and probably acromegaly. Look at her facial features as well. They're rather exaggerated. And she was crippled also, died in her 40s or 50s in 2008. So, you know, you imagine the amount of stress that puts on the joints and the rib cage and the heart and lungs to circulate adequate oxygen. So Yao Ming, basketball player, 7'6", had only gigantism. Look at his facial features. They're not exaggerated and widened like you saw with Andre the Giant or Sandy Allen in the previous picture. If you followed basketball and know anything about his career, guess what ended his basketball career? Yeah, joint injuries, yeah. So he had bad knees. All that weight on those knees was just not able to support that big body. So, yeah, joint injuries are a big deal for people with gigantism. In recent times, this man, Robert Wadlow, was our tallest in recent history. He was 8 foot 11 inches and still not done growing. One thing about growth hormone is that it's suppressed by testosterone. So he had not passed through puberty, even though he was 22 years of age. Wow. So had he lived, You know, imagine how tall this guy might have been. Here's another picture of him with his dad. So he was traveling with the circus back in 1940. He got a blister on his foot from a leg brace, and unfortunately that became infected. This was really before antibiotics had kicked off and become commonplace. Within 2 weeks, he was dead from a body-wide infection from the blister. They buried him in a huge concrete vault in Alton, Illinois, because they were scared somebody would dig him up and parade around his skeleton, and they called him the Alton Giant for this reason. So, you know, if you go down to Myrtle Beach, Ripley's, believe it or not, down there at Main Myrtle, they have on the street side a wax figure of this guy. It is enormously tall, almost 9 feet in height, a figure of this man. So, yeah, imagine if he had continued to live. Testosterone would not have been probably something they thought to give back then, and he would have continued to grow. So acromegaly shows up in places where there's not a lot of flesh. You know, I wouldn't know if my thigh bone got any thicker. I wouldn't know if my humerus bone got any thicker. But there's not a lot of flesh on your hands, feet, and facial bones. So when those bones grow wider, we really notice it. So you can notice here acromegaly has made those hands grow bigger. And notice this man. See how the facial features have become exaggerated due to acromegaly. So people don't wake up tomorrow and say, boy, I think I've got acromegaly. You know, they look at pictures. They may have issues like sleep apnea that come about from having excess bone growth. I don't mean to imply that sleep apnea is what everybody with acromegaly has. It just seems to be one of the symptoms of having the facial bones back in the head grow and shut off that air supply. So nonetheless, look at pictures over people over a lifetime, and you can see that the facial features have really become enlarged. So like this lady here, you notice she's become dramatically different in appearance by the time she's reached her 40s or 50s. On the other end of the growth spectrum is a condition called pituitary dwarfism. And I want to put out there that there's actually 100 different forms of dwarfism. We're only talking about one type of dwarfism caused by the lack of growth hormone. Do you think this mostly affects kids or adults?
Children.
Why children? What happens by the time you're, say, 18 to 21? Your growth stops, right? So if you have any opportunity for upward growth, you got to do it before you're age 18 to 21. So these two people right here are considered pituitary dwarfs. Notice their bodies are completely proportioned. They just look like children standing there in that picture. By contrast, this person and these two have a different form of dwarfism. Those two don't have any issues with growth hormone. So yeah, that's achondroplasia. This is what Little People, Big World on TLC have. It's a growth plate disorder. You could give them growth hormone injections and the growth plates don't respond. So unfortunately, growth hormone would not be a solution for people with that form of dwarfism. This is a thyroid disorder. So again, not a growth hormone issue at all. It's a form of dwarfism called cretinism. We'll talk about that when we get into the thyroid hormones. So yeah, pituitary dwarfism just produces childlike bodies. Technically 4'7" and under is considered dwarfism, but we would test for growth hormone to see if that is the actual cause. I had a student in class many years ago. She came up after class, and she said they had tested her at age 5 and diagnosed her with pituitary dwarfism. Starting at age 5 until she was 14, she took hormone injections of growth hormone every other day, and she said she was very happy with how things turned out. She was 5'2". So given the alternative, she would have been wearing toddler clothes. She was wearing toddler clothes at age 5 and may not have grown much taller than the 4-foot range, you know, by the time she finished growing. So, you know, she said she was happy with what growth hormone had done. Why do you think they stopped her injections around age 14?
So she'd be a growth
hormone. What happens in the teenage years? Puberty. And if they kept giving her growth hormone injections, she wouldn't have grown taller. She would have grown
wider.
Yes, so she would have ended up with acromegaly. So as soon as her epiphyseal plates closed, they said, all right, you're done with those growth hormone injections, and they stopped the injections at that point. Okay, how about questions on these three growth hormone disorders? Okay. Let me get you to the next one there, which is thyroxine. All right, so notice this same trail of control. In order to produce thyroxine by your thyroid gland, control ultimately begins with your hypothalamus. The hypothalamus produces thyroid-releasing hormone. We call it TRH for short. What do all releasing hormones target?
Anterior pituitary.
You've got anterior pituitary. In turn, the anterior pituitary produces a stimulating hormone called TSH. And our stimulating hormones will target an actual gland. So TSH targets the thyroid gland. The thyroid gland makes thyroxine. What does thyroxine do? Metabolism, good. Do you notice alphabetical order TRH comes before TSH? Okay, so TRH, as all releasing hormones, are produced by the hypothalamus, and then of course anterior pituitary makes the next alphabetical one, which is TSH. So I know you guys talked about the rat stuff in lab today. Let's go ahead and tie that in with what we're doing here. If you were to take out the anterior pituitary, would you still be able to produce thyroxine?
No.
Yeah, there's no communication there, right? You could make TRH, but you'd have no way to make TSH. Mm-hmm. What if you took out the anterior pituitary, but you now supplemented with a TSH pill?
Yes.
Yeah, you could now make thyroxine with no problem. Good. What if you took out the hypothalamus and didn't supplement with more TRH? What does that do to the rest of this mechanism? Stops it, yeah. Kills the whole process. What if you took out the hypothalamus, but now you supplemented with TRH? You're still good, yeah. The whole process can still then run, okay? And what if you had a functional hypothalamus and a functional pituitary and their thyroid gland? What would you have to do now? You'd have to give thyroxine, yeah, so you'd have to supplement. Right, so it's kind of like you take out one piece of this communication line and you either supplement or you just don't have the communication continue on. Let's talk about the next one there on your chart. This one is corticotropic releasing hormone. That is what CRH stands for. Let me give you a little history here. Okay, so I know that these words are just awful to try to keep straight. Corticotropic references the cortex of the adrenal gland. So the adrenal gland has an outer portion that's called the cortex and a deeper nervous tissue portion called the medullum. So when you hear the word corticotropic, we're actually talking about what ultimately targets that adrenal cortex, which is the outer portion. Okay, so corticotropic releasing hormone. All releasing hormones are made where? Hypothalamus, good. And they target the?
Anterior pituitary.
Good. Now, you'll notice something called ACTH is made by your anterior pituitary. That stands for adrenocorticotropic stimulating hormone. So AC there stands for adrenal cortex, okay? And the TH, that tropic or stimulating hormone, is going to travel from your anterior pituitary to your adrenal gland. And in response, your adrenal gland makes its own hormones.
What's the ACTH?
ACTH stands for adrenocorticotropic hormone. It's a type of stimulating or tropic hormone that causes changes in the adrenal gland. Yeah, corticotropic releasing hormone. Yeah. Notice the routine. It is the same thing again for this one. G with a little n, RH, stands for gonadotropic releasing hormone. They use the little n so we don't get confused about growth hormone, because this one is not growth hormone. Gonadotropic releasing hormone targets the anterior pituitary. Notice the anterior pituitary makes FSH and LH. That stands for follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. Both men and women produce FSH and LH. They have similar effects. FSH targets the gonads, so does LH. So I left you a blank there in your worksheet if you have the new version. FSH and LH targets the gonads. One of these hormones activates sex cell production, so sperm in males, eggs in females, and the other one activates hormone production, such as testosterone in males and estrogen in females. So ultimately, the target there is going to be to tell the gonads what to do. So we've been through enough of these. I think I'll let you try to figure out prolactin on your own. Let me give you a moment to see if you can figure out those blanks there for prolactin. Go back. Okay, and then finally there for prolactin, if you're talking about PRH, that is the one that turns on prolactin production by your anterior pituitary. What would PIH do?
Inhibit it.
Yes, yeah, stop it. So if you want to turn on milk production, you have to activate prolactin using PRH, and that in turn will target the mammary glands to produce milk. So prolactin literally means for milk. And so its target organ is the mammary glands of the breast tissue. Okay, and of course the role that PIH plays is to shut down prolactin production. Mm-hmm. So this is for females, right? Not for males. If you know a guy who produces breast milk, get him checked. Because there's problems in one of two locations. Where could there be hypersecretion of hormones if a male produces breast milk? Pituitary is one place, and another place is?
Hypothalamus.
Come down closer to the chest.
The breast.
Breast tissue, yeah. Yeah. So either he has breast cancer, breast tissue that's hypersecreting hormones, anterior pituitary, but you know, one of those two locations is quite likely the culprit there. Why don't we review this stuff? This is thick territory. Let's review this on Wednesday, and then we'll keep on trucking with thyroid, parathyroids on Wednesday.